My fellow plebs, River is setting a new standard in Bitcoin. At river.com, you'll pay zero fees when you dollar cost average. Truly the best way to build your Bitcoin wealth. All Bitcoin at River is held in secure cold storage with 100% full reserves. There's no need to wonder what's happening behind the scenes. Your Bitcoin is your Bitcoin to withdraw at any time. Additionally, River lets you make Bitcoin payments via the Lightning Network, offers a Lightning integration for developers, and allows you to mine Bitcoin directly to your River account. River has a level of service that is unheard of in this industry, including phone support, private client advisors, and the ability to designate beneficiaries to inherit your Bitcoin wealth. River has become the premium name in Bitcoin that anyone can easily access. Sure, you have a place to buy Bitcoin, but have you tried River? See and feel the difference at river.com and the River iOS app, the preferred partner of Bitcoin Magazine. Over the last 5 years, the Bitcoin Conference has become the world's largest gathering of Bitcoiners. From breaking announcements and international media coverage to countless meaningful talks by thought leaders and industry innovators, we are excited to continue our drive for global hyper-Bitcoinization. From July 25th to the 27th, 2024, we'll be taking the Bitcoin Conference to the city of Music and Freedom, Nashville, Tennessee. Join thousands of attendees for countless opportunities to learn, engage, and network across 3 days of pure Bitcoin signal. Get your tickets now for the best price at b.tc/conference. You are not going to want to miss what Nashville has in store. My fellow plebs, Bitcoin Magazine is headed back to Amsterdam in 2023. We're returning to Westergaas to build on this historic success and continue our mission of global hyper-Bitcoinization. In its inaugural year, Bitcoin Amsterdam was the biggest European Bitcoin event in history. Held from October 12th to the 14th in 2022 at Westergaas Event Forum, nearly 3,000 attendees jumped at the opportunity to learn, engage, and party with fellow Bitcoiners. 126 brilliant speakers from all over Europe and beyond took the stage to represent different angles and present various perspectives. Offering 6 different on-site locations and 3 fully programmed stages, we are absolutely stoked to catapult the European community to the global stage. Tickets are at their lowest prices right now. Block yours in at b.tc/conference/Amsterdam. That's b.tc/conference/Amsterdam.
I am here with Stephen Pair, the CEO of BitPay. Really excited for this conversation. BitPay is one of the longest running Bitcoin companies out there. They've pretty much been there from the beginning of Bitcoin companies, and they have seen the Bitcoin landscape and the crypto landscape evolve. So Stephen is going to have a ton of incredible insights around building and running a business in this space. So without further ado, let's get right into this one. Stephen, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me, CK. It's great to be on.
So Stephen, tell us just like the little background story of you getting into Bitcoin, starting BitPay. How did it all get started?
Yeah, well, it was late 2010 where I finally sat down and read the Bitcoin white paper. I had heard about Bitcoin when it first launched, but didn't, you know, pay it much attention. But I had, you know, I was very fortunate that prior to all of that, I had gotten excited about something called DigiCash back in the early days, early 1990s. So I was very fascinated with that. I read The Creature from Jekyll Island, you know, read the history of, you know, central banking and all of that kind of stuff as well. And, you know, with all of that background, I still sort of dismissed Bitcoin when I first heard about it. You know, I think the headline on Slashdot at that time when the blockchain first launched was something like run an algorithm on your computer and, you know, create money. I'm like, there's no way that could work. But like I said, at the end of 2010, I read the white paper, got more engaged in like February that of 2011 when it hit dollar parity for the first time, and started mining Bitcoin, buying up graphics cards and all that kind of stuff. And then started talking to my co-founder about that time, Tony. And, you know, he and I had sort of reconnected over Facebook, knew each other from college, and sort of in the aftermath of 2008, we were, you know, trading, doing some options trading and things like that. So I pointed out Bitcoin to him. He kind of, you know, had, I think his words were, you know, you better sell all that before the government makes it illegal. fortunately, I didn't do that. And we kept, you know, kept talking about it over the course of the next couple of months. And one thing led to another, and we started BitPay. And Tony wrote me a long, you know, email about how we should make it easy for companies to accept Bitcoin as payment. And I think my response to him was like, sure, let's do it. And that's how it began.
So did either of you have experience in the payments industry prior to founding BitPay?
No, not really. You know, we were in our careers, you know, a decade or two into our careers. My background was mostly telecommunications. I did a little bit with banking software, about a year worth of work on a banking software platform. But other than that, not really any experience in payments.
So I want to talk about, you know, your experience kind of like learning what it takes to be a part of the payments game. But prior to getting into that, I want to kind of stick to discovering Bitcoin. David Bailey, the CEO of BTC Inc., he told me that back in 2013, you were the most bullish guy he knew on Bitcoin. it takes a lot to be like, obviously, like lots of people are bullish on Bitcoin. But if you if you rewind back to then when it was so much earlier, it was a lot more difficult to be hyper bullish. Tell us about how did you build up that kind of conviction in Bitcoin? And you know, what was it like, you know, being a Bitcoin hyper bull back then?
Yeah, I mean, it was really just, I guess, going back to my DigiCash, you know, experience, my understanding of central banking and the, you know, reading a lot of the, you know, sort of libertarian stuff about, or the Austrian school of economics and things like that. And then looking at and thinking about this problem of creating money, right? When DigiCash first came out, I heard some quote that said, you know, there's this, you know, worthless piece of paper with worthless ink stamped on it. And yet for some reason, people assign that value. And the conclusion from that was that must be an information system, if that's the case. So if it's an information system, we should be able to replicate that entirely in the digital realm. And you have to remember back in the 1990s, we were still doing a lot with cash, and credit cards are just beginning to be used on the internet. And so it was, you know, I spent a lot of time thinking in those days, like, how would you create money for the internet that didn't require like a centralized company to run it? And remember, DigiCash was, or I don't know if you remember it or even know of it, but DigiCash was, they used cryptography, but it was a centralized system. And so they ultimately went bankrupt, and that payment system went away with it. And I think that got a lot of people thinking, you know, how can you create a protocol for payments on the internet that doesn't depend on that central issuer? And so when Bitcoin came along and I finally, you know, studied it and read the white paper, and, you know, as a computer scientist, it was like a very straightforward, simple white paper, right? Got right to the point. And usually the best inventions, the best, you know, sort of breakthroughs, when you look at them, it's sort of obvious in hindsight, right? It's like, oh, why didn't we think about this 20 years earlier? Why did it take so long? And so the attributes of Bitcoin, the fact that, you know, there's a limit of 21 million, it was, you know, a consensus protocol, and that all the participants, users and miners, enforced, that meant there could never be more than 21 million and you could trust that. That's why I was so bullish on it, right? And I mean, to me, from a computer science perspective, this is the biggest breakthrough I've ever seen. And you know, I felt like there was a very good chance it was going to become a very big deal, and that was worth investing time into.
Yeah, I mean, I can remember when I first kind of woke up to Bitcoin and actually, you know, kind of grokked how big of a deal it could be. But that was 2017. And you know, a lot more education and a lot more information had really been spread about it. But I kind of want to go back to, you know, your vision for Bitcoin. Back then, this idea of hyper-Bitcoinization was kind of like a fresh idea. Mm-hmm. Is that something that is like relevant now today to like think about coin being adopted globally and becoming like this general standard for money?
Yeah, well, it seems like it's happening. You know, I in all these years, I've never really changed my perspective on Bitcoin and that thought that it could become, you know, it could completely reform a foundation for the financial system globally. I think it very much has that potential. I'm probably more bullish on it today than I was back then, simply because we've seen a lot more. It's survived. It hasn't, you know, I always used to say back then, it's either gonna, if it sticks around and it just works, it just does what it's supposed to do, it's almost inevitable that it's gonna, you know, sort of eat the traditional financial system. And I think the having now more than a decade, 12 years of history behind it, it seems even more likely that that's going to happen. So, yeah, I forgot exactly what the question was, but that's kind of my thought.
No, I think that was a good answer. You know, I was just kind of asking, like, is the idea of hyper-Bitcoinization still relevant, you know, after you've been kind of watching it for 8 years? But I think you definitely, you hit on it.
Well, that hyper-Bitcoinization concept, idea, you know, I don't think it's fairly recently that's been a thing that people talk about. I think back then it was more like, here's this new thing. How can we make it grow? How can we make it become relevant? You know, and you felt like if the system worked, it's inevitably going to be a great store of value over time. And if it's a great store of value over time, people come to trust in that, then people are just going to find ways to use it. Mm-hmm. And that growth leads to more adoption. You know, I still don't think we've hit mainstream adoption yet, but it's getting there. And it seems inevitable.
No, I actually contend that most people are not bullish enough because they think we're actually further along in adoption. And I think we're much earlier than even, yeah, you know, some, you know, experts, you know, say we are.
So I always tell people, you know, when I, you know, acquired my first Bitcoin, it was at $1.10. And the funny thing was that, you know, Bitcoin had just hit $1. Right. It just reached dollar parity. And that was, you know, made all the headlines and all, you know, all the tech pubs and whatnot. We're talking about that. But at that time, there were people out there that were like, I missed it. I'm too late. If you can believe that. I tell people that story today. I'm like, no, you're still very early. It's still very early in Bitcoin's history. And you're not late at all. If anything, you're still early. So, yeah, it's hard to imagine that people even back, you know, in 2011 thought that they missed the move and it was too late to get in.
Yeah. And I would contend we're still in that paradigm of sats being unfairly cheap, especially for fiat. So, you know, you mentioned that throughout, you know, Bitcoin's 12-year history, you know, we've seen hyper-Bitcoinization kind of happening and we've seen trust build and Bitcoin as a store of value kind of become cemented. You know, when I joined Bitcoin, it was in 2017. Obviously, that was a very contentious time. And, you know, there was a fork kind of battle happening. I'm very curious, like, what your perspective on, like, kind of like the lessons of scaling Bitcoin, Bitcoin Cash, and, you know, what kind of unfolded from that?
Yeah, well, at the time, you had miners who were not wanting to deploy SegWit. And then you had the developers, the core developers.
SegWit's an upgrade. Is an upgrade to Bitcoin, right?
Yeah, SegWit was a soft fork upgrade to Bitcoin. So you had miners on the one hand that were very reluctant to signal that they would start enforcing SegWit's consensus rules. And on the other side, you had the core developers who did not want to do a hard fork to increase the block size, but you also had, not too dissimilar to what we're seeing recently in the fee market, you had transactions costing $20 and up. And at the time, we at BitPay, we were, you know, under a lot of pressure to add other blockchains, namely Ethereum. Our competitors were adding it. Our merchants were asking for it. And we were still a Bitcoin-only company at that time. And so we felt like it mattered a lot for us to kind of get involved in that. And, you know, they had the whole New York agreement. They came up with this plan for SegWit 2X that would do both the SegWit as well as a doubling of the block size. And SegWit itself was an increase in the block size. SegWit was a large amount of code chain, which I think made people nervous. But at the same time, the core developers were like, okay, if you double the block size, that's a hard fork. It's inherently divergent. You're going to have two blockchains after that. And there's a lot of questions it raises about governance, right? If
you can force everybody to accept it to, you know, a doubling of the block size, a consensus rule change like that, then what does it say about decentralization and governance and everything? And so it became this huge war that, you know, you can go read about and, you know, kind of study. We could go on and on, you know, about that. I think, you know, from our perspective, it felt like the community was going to just divide. And it was, you know, SegWit 2x was this opportunity maybe to keep everybody on the same blockchain for at least a little while longer, you know, but at that point in time, Bitcoin was big enough that doing a hard fork, or even you could argue SegWit, you know, making a big change like that to the system was not a good idea, because there's a lot of value in systems that are stable and well understood, and people can build around that. But if you go around changing it every year or two, then, you know, it becomes less, it becomes more fragile. And so,
absolutely. Anyway. I mean, that's one of the biggest differentiators between Bitcoin as we know it today and pretty much all of its competitors.
Yeah. I mean, if you can hard fork, like you can force people into a hard fork, like every, you know, 6 months or a year, then that's not, I mean, that system has to be centralized to some degree, to a large degree. In the early days, there were changes made to Bitcoin. There were hard forks, some out of necessity because of a bug or whatever. But that was when it was much smaller. And I think you get to a certain point, to a certain stage, you need to stop changing it.
Absolutely. And, you know, there was a lot of, like, that fight in 2017 got very emotional, and I don't necessarily want to bring up any of that. I'm, you know, I'm just trying to understand, you know, the learnings. And even back then, I don't think, you know, people think Bitcoin governance is clear today. It's not clear at all today. No one knows how it works. And back in 2017, it was even less clear, right? Yeah. And there was a lot of experimentation elsewhere. You know, a lot of what we learned about Bitcoin, I think we learned in 2017 and 2018 in terms about the dynamics of the game theory of the system. I guess, how has your mind around hard forking as a viable method kind of changed through that experience?
Well, I think a hard fork has to be just done. Like, you know, advocates of that fork need to accept that they're going to create a fork and not try and force everybody on the same. There's going to be two blockchains after that fork, right? And, you know, you just have to accept that there's going to be two blockchains. The market will sort it out. Not try and force people on one side or the other. I think soft forks, you know, what I also learned in that during that period is that soft forks have the potential to be very insidious. So you could almost change anything about Bitcoin through a soft fork. And of course, you have to have miners cooperate to start enforcing, you know, the rules of a soft fork. But, you know, in the future, people should, I think, be, you know, very critical of any soft forks and you know, cautious about them, because there could be some unwanted changes and undesirable, or there could be unanticipated side effects.
100%.
But on the other side, you know, like doubling the block size, you know, the viewpoint of people advocating for that were, you know, like it's a one line code change, sort of. It is a one line code change, but then you have to manage that forking process. And that introduces a lot more changes and code changes that have to be implemented to sort of manage that process, as they found out as they were trying to start to build the version of the client that would navigate that SegWit 2x transition. It was quite complicated, actually. So
totally.
But the other thing about, like, anything like that, like doubling of the block size, even the SegWit, which expanded the block size, it sort of changes the contract that the system has with, you know, miners, for example. So if you double the block size, you're now all of a sudden creating more space in the blockchain. So that can have a very big impact on the fee market. And so you don't want things like that being changed out from underneath people, especially miners who have, you know, deployed, you know, tens of millions of dollars worth of infrastructure in these warehouses to mine. And now all of a sudden you're changing sort of the rules. It's almost like changing the 21 million Bitcoin limit.
Introducing the Gatekeepers issue, the Q1 2023 print release from Bitcoin Magazine. The winter editorial serves as both a reminder of the sacrifice whistleblowers have made in the pursuit of truth and the call to arms for a new generation. Order it now from BitcoinMagazine.com. There is a thin line between curation and censorship. There is an even thinner line between moderation and constitutional violation. The Gatekeepers issue explores the liminal space between these nuances, painting the fences worthy of demolition and those deserving respect. Bitcoin Magazine is for all Bitcoiners, the curious, convicted, and the maximalists. Subscribe today for exclusive interviews and profiles with leading Bitcoiners, actionable insights on the state of the market, breaking news and cultural trends, powerful photos and artwork from the best artists in the world. Don't miss out on this piece of Bitcoin history. Subscribe now at store.bitcoinmagazine.com. Bitcoiners, if you're like me and want to gain a deeper understanding of what's going on within the Bitcoin market and broader macro environment, you need to subscribe to Bitcoin Magazine Pro today. There's both a free and paid version of this daily newsletter where our market analysts Dylan LeClaire and Sam Rule break down what's going on in the market so you don't have to. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com. So what are you waiting for? Don't delay. Subscribe today at BitcoinMagazinePro.com and embark on a path towards Bitcoin mastery. Get ready to seize every opportunity in the market with Bitcoin Magazine Pro today.
I was going to say, I feel like now in 2023, we're almost reliving a lot of those lessons again. And there is a lot of heartburn, even about SegWit and Taproot, which have, you know, the two most recent soft fork updates, because they have enabled people to put non-transaction data on Bitcoin, and some Bitcoin best practices, as I call them, really hate that.
But we've been having
about how that works into the future too.
Yeah, but we've been having that debate forever. Like even back in 2011, we were having about putting data in op return, and then they shortened the amount of data you could put in op return, which I'm not sure what that accomplishes, because you just spread the data over more transactions. But yeah, this, it's funny to hear this come up again, but it's been there forever. And it's like, okay, you have a choice. It's either you're going to have a censored centralized blockchain, or you're going to have a decentralized censorship resistant blockchain. Which do you want? If you want the decentralized censorship resistant blockchain, then people are going to be able to put whatever data they want in that blockchain, you know. And I don't know that. So inscriptions, you know, they're utilizing some new method to do it that was introduced with Taproot, but I don't know that fundamentally anything is different about that from when you could do it with op return, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the difference is that SegWit made a block or a SegWit discount for witness data, and then Taproot kind of enabled some new stuff. So I think it's just the fact that there was maybe unintended edge cases, or edge cases that, you know, people who were supposedly thinking through all the edge cases and were so confident they didn't see. And it's almost like an emotional backlash to it. But I think it's also a good lesson. You know, I'd prefer there to be, you know, less harmful edge cases that teach us a lesson versus, you know, maybe something that can existentially, you know, damage Bitcoin.
Yeah, I'm not sure what argument people would make that it's any kind of existential threat to Bitcoin. I mean, sure, it raises the fees, it increases congestion on the network, but fortunately for us, you know, we went through that in 2017 and we built lots of infrastructure to deal with a congested blockchain and high fees so that payments still go through. But yeah, I'm not sure. I haven't heard any really good arguments about how that this could possibly be a threat. Maybe like if, you know, some of the rules around the inscriptions cause you to do weird things with how you prioritize transactions that miners include. And, you know, the witness discount you mentioned, well, that's an interesting case. You know, those rules are really just conventions that are built into the software that miners follow just because they run the out of the box software. But miners could decide to charge the same amount for the witness data as they charge for every other byte in the system if they wanted to. And then that would just change which transactions they select to be put into a block. And I guess you'd do that at the mining pool level. And then just kind of tell people, okay, we're going to charge the same amount for this data, you know, this witness data, as we charge for regular data. And we're going to prioritize the transactions this way. And, you know, miners would be free to do that. That's not really a part of consensus. It's part of convention built into the software.
How closely are you kind of following this like the recent kind of drama on the internet?
I don't follow it very closely at all. I hear bits and pieces. I've watched some podcasts and hear people talk about the pros and cons. But to me, it really just is the same argument we had back in 2011 about alpha return at the end of the day. With the caveat that maybe the inscriptions and the rules about those transactions could fundamentally alter miner behavior in ways that made the base use case of Bitcoin, you know, for payments and store value, not work. But as far as I can tell, it's worked just fine through all the congestion. It might be a little more expensive. It's worked.
So I want to pivot to something you mentioned, which is that, you know, you've seen a high fee environment, and because of that, Pay and other players in the space have, you know, built solutions in order to scale payments out. I'm kind of curious, you know, what is your perspective on Bitcoin as a payment solution and competitor in that realm? And how does Bitcoin scale to actually serve the world for that use case?
Yeah, well, you always have the question of what kind of payments are you talking about? If you're talking about high value settlement type transactions or people making large purchases, you know, Bitcoin works great. You know, the fees there have never gotten to any kind of point where there are any threat to that use case. And that's for the on-chain payments. But then you also have Lightning. So we added Lightning a couple of years ago to our invoices so that Lightning wallets can pay those invoices using the Lightning network. And, you know, we've been continuing to experiment and work on that, and you have plans to do more with that in the future. And Lightning seems to work. You know, it's just been, yeah, I won't say it's not been a lot of effort to get it working, but now that we've got it deployed and working, it seems to be fine. And I think there's some risk on Lightning that, you know, it reminds me of like the DNS system that is sort of what I would describe as distributed, but could have centralizing forces on it. You know, but that's okay, because I think you can always fall back on the base chain. You can always spin up new routing nodes to take some load off of existing infrastructure that's become more centralized. So I think it's going to be okay in that regard, you know, but Lightning can handle those tiny payments. And the real hard part about Lightning is working out the usability, especially if you want self-custody. You don't want to just depend on a third party provider to run your Lightning and store your Satoshis. That is a big challenge. I haven't seen any great solutions to that yet, but I also think Lightning has some other potentials there. I've seen some projects working on doing like sort of chat over the Lightning network. So you have this built-in network of nodes that are making these point-to-point routed connections. And I always thought, what if you could run TCP over top of those nodes and also pay for setting up connections, transmitting data. So you could pay in Satoshis for data transmitted over the Lightning network, and you could host websites over that network. You would solve a lot of the problems that the internet has today with things like DDoS attacks. You know, DDoS would become a thing of the past in an environment like that, because you're having to pay for the bandwidth you're sending and the traffic that you're sending to a website. And as it gets more congested, either, you know, it becomes bandwidth constrained and fees go up, and no DDoS, right? You're only receiving the traffic that your infrastructure can handle. So I think there's a lot of potential for Lightning, you know, as a network. You know, it could do a lot of things, and especially when it has a payment system built in at its foundation.
So you think that Bitcoin scales through Lightning right now? Do you think that is that fair to say?
Yes. You know, you basically have infinite scalability of payments through Lightning.
So How is BitPay planning to build with Lightning versus, you know, I guess other blockchains moving forward?
Yeah. Well, so, you know, back in 2017, we were a Bitcoin only company, but like I said, we were coming under a lot of pressure to add other blockchains. Ethereum was the main one at the time. And, you know, our merchants were demanding it. Our customers were demanding it. So we've added a lot of chains and a lot of coins over the years because of exactly that, because our customers want it. And, you know, right or wrong, if your customers want it and there's a market for it, think, you know, running a business, you have to serve that market. You have to consider that market. And, we've been very successful in rolling out support for new blockchains and supporting those communities. And, we will continue to do that as well. I think there is some debate. Does Lightning take over market share, or does another blockchain take the load off of the Bitcoin network and people just go use Litecoin or something? The market will decide that. I think Lightning is a great technology and we should do everything we can with it. But it's possible users could decide that they'll just move some of their activity over to something like Litecoin.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily know if there's like the altcoin thesis is something that vibes with me, but I can definitely see the payment use case being dominated by stablecoins. And I think that we're already seeing a lot of that globally right now. What are you seeing on the BitPay platform in terms of, maybe let's call it smaller payments, mm-hmm. what's the breakdown between Bitcoin, Bitcoin on Lightning, stablecoins, other?
Yeah. So stablecoins now are probably 25%, somewhere in that neighborhood of our volume. And I think they're great, but I see potential problems with them going forward. If you talk about US dollar stablecoins, well, now you have companies out there creating US dollars in this new format, and they're not within the Federal Reserve System. So I think that's not going to be tolerated by the Federal Reserve for very long. So, I mean, they're going to want whoever's doing that, or if they want to introduce their own CBDC, it's going to have to be within the Federal Reserve System, if that makes sense. If you take a look at like Tether's been creating US dollars, and there's not a lot of transparency in what's backing those dollars. So it could be that they're running a fractional reserve. And that's something that is an activity, at least as far as US dollars are concerned, that is reserved for, member banks of the Federal Reserve System. So I don't know what the future is going to hold for stablecoins, at least US dollar stablecoins. There's probably going to be, my guess would be, some legislation, some regulatory, action that says, okay, if you're going to do dollars in this form, here are your requirements. Those requirements are going to be very much like running a bank, but they work. And you eliminate a lot of the issues around the price volatility involved in payments, especially in the US, where you have capital gains that you've got to track. If you have gains, you have to pay taxes on them. And so it solves a lot of those issues. But I think those are also solvable issues with Bitcoin. And it will eventually, through good UX design and automatic tracking of capital gains and whatnot, we can solve those issues in the Bitcoin form. As far as other blockchains, interestingly, we've seen Litecoin payments rise quite a bit, and they're much smaller payments than we see on Bitcoin, but they're getting to a point where the number of payments that people are making, not in terms of volume, but just the times people use Litecoin, is almost reaching parity with Bitcoin on our platform. So that's, I think, pretty significant. So, we are seeing good adoption, of Litecoin.
Interesting. Litecoin is something that I haven't even thought about since 2017, really. So, I've kind of just been ignoring it. I don't want to stick on the altcoin talk too much, but tell us a little bit more about the nature of the Bitcoin transactions that are happening. I know it tends to skew like high value items and products, but mm-hmm. I'm kind of curious, what are you seeing on both ends of those markets?
Yeah. So when the price, hits all new all-time highs, people tend to want to buy things, and they do buy luxury goods, cars, boats, jewelry, things like that. Yeah. That's what they tend to be buying on our platform. And that's always been the case. I mean, that's been the case for, ever since we've been around. And, but then you see on the other side of it, when the price declines, our payments volumes decline. So in recent years, been focusing a little bit more on the hodler side and trying to add, enhance our wallet, add the features that, hodlers would want. And we've got more things on the roadmap as far as that's concerned, integrating the ability to buy crypto directly from your wallet. So that gives us, you know, better revenue streams on the other side of the equation when the price drops. You know, it's usually the biggest activity we see in terms of people wanting to buy, you know, Bitcoin and other crypto is usually at the beginning of a sort of bull market. It's not, you know, once it's reaching its peak, volume starts to tail off. And then when it's on the down slope, it's, you know, people are trying to buy and trying to catch the bottom, but the volumes aren't quite substantial. It's just sort of in that upslope when the price is ramping up that you tend to see the most activity. And that's both people accumulating Bitcoin as well as spending it.
Yeah, I mean, that's really interesting. I can think of a lot of reasons why it's the case. That's kind of like it's a good signal for the beginning of the bull run is those volumes. I guess with that being said, are we entering into a bull run yet, Stephen, or do we have more pain to go?
I mean, I always hate making price predictions, but I do think there's a, I mean, it almost seems like we're setting up for a perfect storm, you know, from a macro economic perspective. You're starting to see the Federal Reserve ease off of the interest rate hikes. I think something's going to break. Saw the banks having issues a couple months ago, and now all of a sudden, and Bitcoin held up and actually went up in price as a result of that. So I think, yeah, that's making people view Bitcoin a little bit differently. I think a lot of the analysts out there that, you know, just thought Bitcoin's going to trade with the stock market are now seeing it, you know, separate from the stock market a little bit. And it's not just a pure risk asset. And I always tell people, I think, and this is not financial advice, but I think of Bitcoin as, you know, in the short run, it trades like a risk asset. And in the longer term, it trades more like a risk off asset. And I think it's demonstrated that over time. And you look at, you know, just the history of the cycles. So you have that macro environment sort of setting up for later in this year, maybe even some easing, and potentially a return of inflation in combination with the halving coming next year. And then you have other things like on Friday, BlackRock announcing going to launch the ETF, you know, so I think it's almost a perfect storm for, you know, setting up another Bitcoin bull run. And if you look at history, timing wise, it lines up with what Bitcoin has done historically. So yeah, I kind of have been, I would not be surprised to see Bitcoin trade up north of, you know, 250 to 500,000 and by 2025.
I know my wife would like that. That's for sure. The reason I just kind of asked is, you know, are we starting a bull run? Is just because I'm kind of curious what the volumes are telling you. Are the volumes on BitPay indicating or not? So it sounds like we're not quite there yet. I think we're still. And if I were to think back to 2019, when we kind of had that rally up to 14,000 and then back down to some painful lows, 6 to 3K, feel like we may be in that kind of a ride in the cycle, but you know, who knows? That's just my gut feeling.
No, I agree with that. I also tell people doesn't mean it won't trade down to 15,000 before it gets to half a million.
No, absolutely. Well, and just to kind of stick on the cycle talk and focus on BitPay as a business, you know, Bitcoin Magazine is a business operating in a bull and bear markets. BitPay has done it longer and potentially and arguably better than, you know, pretty much anyone else out there. How do you navigate that? And how do you find ways to anticipate the growth and then find ways to kind of anticipate the declines?
Well, yeah, having been through it and having made mistakes, not navigated it well in the past, you learn from that. And I think when the market's in the midst of that bull run, you just don't get ahead of yourself and you kind of plan for the next downturn. And, you know, it is cyclical and it's proven to be cyclical. So you just try to not get ahead of yourself, right? Knowing that tomorrow it's a different day and that the price of Bitcoin may be quite, you know, substantially different the next day. And you know, another thing I think a lot of companies in the space have not done well is they take a position in the asset and it goes up. And now all of a sudden they do a bunch of hiring thinking they're going to have all this growth that then doesn't materialize. Maybe they have for a while, you know, maybe a lot less. but they don't separate their investment in, you know, in the asset from the profitability of the operation of the business itself. Right. And that's what we tried to do. We completely isolate what, you know, the day-to-day operations, the expenses that we have with BitPay, the profitability of it from any kind of investment that we have in Bitcoin. And we think about those very independently.
I mean, it sounds like excellent, excellent advice. Don't get ahead of your skis. Don't outgrow yourself. You know, if you're going to hold Bitcoin, you know, make sure that you're at least managing your expenses and you're treating it, you know, I think you should just denominate whatever you're going to pay your expenses in, whatever, you know, you should just hold whatever your expenses are denominated in. So as much as I love Bitcoin, if your expenses are denominated in USD, you should probably think about holding that, you know, at least for your known expenses. But yeah, I think that's great advice, but it's not easy, especially when you're the bullish, you know, one of the most bullish men in the world on Bitcoin. You know, how do you kind of, you know, not get ahead of your skis when things are going to the moon for the first time, when you hit $1,000 Bitcoin for the first time, you hit $20,000 Bitcoin? How do you, like, what kind of mental fortitude does it kind of take to manage that?
I would say mental fortitude that we've not always had at times. Yeah, it's, I mean, you just, again, you have to think about that investment separate from your operations. And, you know, it's just tempting. It's tempting to think. And the other aspect of it is, you know, what are your competitors doing? Maybe with the price of Bitcoin running up, they're making huge investments and they're going to outpace you by virtue of that. And, you know, it's tempting to want to spend that money and to try and keep up with them, right? And that's not an easy thing to, you don't know exactly how much they're investing, what they're building, how good it is, when it's coming out. And so you don't know. It's very difficult to judge how much you should be. And you can also say, well, okay, they're spending all that money and then there's going to be a downturn and then they're going to go out of business, right? So, you know, it's that competitive dynamic makes it difficult as well.
Totally.
That's yeah, I mean, point. When the price is running up and you've got this investment that's doing well, it's hard not to spend that money.
Yeah, and you know, in my short time in Bitcoin, I've seen both equations like yield winners. The conservative player that didn't didn't scale into the bull market per se, I've seen them win against their competitors that have done the opposite. And then on the flip side, you've seen the team that's raised money and scaled into a bull market, and they're the ones able to potentially, you know, take advantage, and then they have a massive advantage over their competitors. So it's hard to tell which strategy is the right strategy to take. And honestly, timing is really everything.
Yeah.
You know, I want to kind of continue talking about Bitcoin as a payments vehicle. You know, one of the biggest things kind of in the way is just the tax burden that is kind of associated with, you know, every time you spend Bitcoin, there's a capital gain or capital loss or some sort of more complex accounting that is kind of a burden on users. Is BitPay, you know, involved in potentially trying to change that? Like, are you involved in Bitcoin advocacy in general?
Mm-hmm. You know, we participate in a number of different industry groups, you know, on the subject of capital gains. I mean, it'd be great if they just got rid of capital gains. That would make it all a lot simpler. I don't see that happening in the US anytime soon. There are countries around the world where they don't have capital gains tax. And you can make the argument that you really shouldn't, because it creates, you know, it inhibits the efficient, you know, deployment of capital when you have capital gains tax. And that's efficient deployment of capital is beneficial to the economy and then beneficial to, you know, receivables by the government as a result. But I don't see capital gains tax going away. There have been efforts to try and have de minimis exemptions to capital gains especially when you use Bitcoin as a payment method. That's fine. I don't mind that. It doesn't make the software any easier though, because you still have to track whether or not you're below the de minimis exemption, in which case you have to track the capital gains and losses. So you need the software to do that, to help you with that, to avoid having to do it manually. And so it actually doesn't help the case as far as making, the only thing that would really help that would be to just get rid of the capital gains tax. Maybe just for, you know, in an ideal world, things that are meant to be currencies would just not have capital gains tax associated with them. But again, I don't see that happening. I think that's unlikely. And so what we're left with is just working on the user interface, making it so that we can have software that helps people track capital gains and losses. And there's a lot of companies that are working on that out there. And we've integrated with a few of them in our wallet, but they basically pull in the data from your wallet and they calculate, you know, the ins and the outs from the wallet, and they can also tie into your exchange accounts and, you know, and calculate. It's a non-trivial problem because you might buy crypto and bring it into a wallet somewhere, then you might move it to an exchange and, you know, you acquired it in the wallet, but you sold it on the exchange, and, you know, the transaction that happened moving it from the wallet to the exchange, well, that doesn't. That should not factor into the capital gains and losses. So that's a non-trivial problem.
Yeah, and there's a lot of gotchas, right? That while you're using it, you can make, even if you're, you know, full, the best faith possible, a good faith actor trying to do their best. Mm-hmm. You know, like you said, you know, light kind transfers moving from one thing to another. There's a lot of areas where there potentially could be some sort of reporting mistake, and then who knows what that will, you know, read to into the future, you know, from a legal perspective. So it's definitely, I think it's tricky. It's something that, you know, we're going to have to figure out, at least in the United States as a country. But I'm optimistic too. You know, we're seeing Bitcoin become legal tender and typically in other countries, and typically legal tender in other countries is kind of exempt from that, you know, from capital gains, is treated more like a currency. So, you know, maybe there's a lot more potential of Bitcoin just being recognized as a currency rather than changing laws per se.
That would be great.
Are you kind of following what's happening, you know, on the nation state level with Bitcoin adoption? I'm sure, you know, 2021 with mm-hmm. the El Salvador announcement, I'm not sure if that surprised you or came faster than you expected, but I'm kind of curious on what your perspective is there.
Yeah, I mean, it was surprising. And, you know, I mean, my thoughts on it are, you know, first of all, what does it mean to be legal tender, right? Or declared legal tender? I think what it means is it has some kind of legal standing. You know, there's always that phrase in the US that the US dollars must be accepted for all debts, public and private. And I think that's a legal thing where if you have a judgment in a court that says you owe this person that much money, or this company owes that other company this much money, that you have to, dollars have to be allowed as the payment mechanism for settling that debt. So maybe in El Salvador, that's the case with Bitcoin, that, you know, you have to accept on a legal basis, Bitcoin has to be accepted for all debts, public and private. But I saw some language in there that said everybody must accept Bitcoin as a form of payment, which I don't necessarily like that. I want people to use Bitcoin because they love Bitcoin and they like Bitcoin. They want to accept Bitcoin, not because they're forced to. And I think there's some backlash in El Salvador over that. But on the balance, it's really interesting to see, you know, all of the activity going on in El Salvador and people moving there. I haven't been there personally, but, you know, just seeing some podcasts about their, you know, what's happening in El Salvador with respect to Bitcoin, that's really exciting to see. And I'm really fascinated to watch how that develops over time.
To close it out, Stephen, I want to talk a little bit more about BitPay's product suite. So obviously you were one of the first merchant or the first coin processors for merchants, but since then built a wallet, you're building exchange services. I know your debit card is really popular for people who are, you know, trying to live off their Bitcoin.
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us about like the complete suite and what experience you're building for users.
Yeah. So you mentioned, you know, what we're best known for is our payment processing services. So if you're a merchant, you can sign up, get a merchant account, start accepting Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies from your customers. We also do payouts. So companies can utilize that to pay affiliates or in crypto or pay their employees. We built it for our own payroll at BitPay because everybody at BitPay wanted to get paid in Bitcoin, right? So we built it for ourselves and then productized it. And then, so those are some of our company services. On the consumer side, we have the BitPay wallet. That wallet integrates with some services that sell crypto. So we make it, you know, make a seamless user experience to buy crypto from one of those partners of ours and have it just show up in your wallet. You can also buy gift cards there. You mentioned the debit card. Our issuing bank has gotten out of the crypto business. So we're shutting that program down and in the process of launching a new one with a new bank soon. And so there's a waiting list if you want to sign up. If anybody wants to sign up for that, they can go to bitpay.com and get on the waiting list to get notified about when that product is available. And then also within the wallet, if you need to swap from one crypto to another, we do have partners that we integrate with so that you have a seamless experience. And, you know, if you want to convert some Ethereum back into Bitcoin, you know, that you can use that partner and do it right in the wallet seamlessly. And, you know, you don't necessarily need to have our wallet to buy crypto. You can go to our website and, you know, put in whatever you want to buy, and we'll show you a list of different partners and options and their prices, whether they're available in your region or not. It's sort of like an aggregator for different services that sell crypto. So you don't need to even download our wallet to utilize that. Of course, if you have our wallet, it's, you know, simplifies some of the steps because the crypto is going to come right to your wallet. And I think that basically covers it.
With the BitPay wallet, does the BitPay wallet also support Lightning directly?
No, not yet. It's coming. That's one of the main things we're working on. We're trying to do that in a way that's self-custodial. That's proving to be quite a challenge. We'll figure it out. You know, it's a challenge.
It hasn't been a simple solution. Yeah, for sure. It's like, you know, I'm a heavy user, and, you know, there's like four or five decent options. When the fee environment was low, Moon Wallet was really cool because it was pretty much an on-chain wallet, and then they used atomic swaps to Lightning, but that's not scalable.
Yeah. What do they call those? Either high. Submarine swaps.
Yeah, right? Submarine swaps. Yeah. But, you know, I would be very interested in the solution that BitPay comes up with. If you can come up with something novel, it's been a tough problem. Yeah, Phoenix Wallet, Zeus Wallet, both interesting options. Yeah. I think Zeus is for your node though. So,
that's another thing about, you know, BitPay invoices and paying merchants. We do a lot of testing with all the different wallets, and, you know, for a long time, we tried to boil it down to just a QR code or a link that you hit that opened the wallet and you pay. And we'd like to get there one day, but that's a lot of that has to do with, you know, wallet standards and protocols and things like that. And so we backed off with that and just said, let's just figure out exactly what they're paying with. And, you know, you can put in your wallet. Your browser can remember which wallet you chose last. So it makes it easy for you to select that again. And then we do a lot of testing. So if there are certain behaviors that certain wallets have that can cause problems, then we'll, you know, tell the user, hey, do the X, Y, and Z to avoid making these errors.
Yeah.
But that takes a lot of effort. But we've tested all the different Lightning wallets as well. But we don't have Lightning in our wallet yet. Mm-hmm. We're working on that. And we do want to make it truly self-custodial and not in any way dependent on any centralized service. So, you know, and then one of the things that our wallet's always been good about is just the UX around setting up multi-signature wallets. So either where you want multiple people involved in a workflow, or it's one person, but you want the security of multiple devices, right? Multi-factor authentication. So I would say and we're going to add additional features, you know, that would appeal to hodlers, like hardware integration, integrating with some of the hardware wallets, air gap signing, you know, tool, you know, non-GUI or command line clients for all of that as well, so that we can sort of minimize the amount of code that's involved in handling those private keys, so that it makes it more auditable. Yeah. So we got a lot of big plans for the wallet.
Well, it's cool to hear the investment in non-custodial solutions as well as a lot of the advanced features. So I know a lot of listeners of Bitcoin Magazine, you know, these are the diehards who, you know, they're building Bitcoin in the bear and the bull markets.
Yeah.
Steven, it's been awesome to have you on the show. It's been great to ask you, you know, about lessons learned. I think, you know, all of us and Bitcoin, it's important to humble ourselves. We're so early and there's so much we don't know. And it's awesome to get to learn from someone like yourself who's, you know, been building a business for so long. Want to give you a chance to wrap up with a last word.
Oh gosh. You know, I would say, you know, with Bitcoin, I'm still every bit as bullish and optimistic as I've always been since 2011. You know, it's a platform built for, you know, stability and security. And I think it's the best option for, you know, a digital store of value. And, you know, that comes directly from the power of the the computer securing that blockchain. You know, so I think as a store of value, you won't find anything better.
Awesome. Well, I 100% agree. Excited to have you back on in a few, Stephen. Hopefully there's more fireworks and we can tease it apart here on the Bitcoin Magazine podcast. Thanks again for coming on. To everyone listening, catch me at Bitcoin Amsterdam this October. We are going to be having an incredible time in Amsterdam, trying to orange pill as many folks from the Netherlands and from Europe as possible. But until then, we'll be back with another interview here at Bitcoin Magazine podcast. Peace.
Thank you, Miami, for the last 3 years in this amazing city. The whole world shut down, but Miami welcomed us with open arms. We want to show Bitcoin to the whole world. We are taking the conference on the road to set the stage for Bitcoin in a new city. Nashville. Bitcoin 2024 is coming to Nashville in Tennessee, a city that is known as a music and freedom city. Bitcoin 2024 in Nashville from July 25th to 27th.
My fellow plebs, Bitcoin Magazine is headed back to Amsterdam in 2023. We're returning to Westergaas to build on this historic success and continue our mission of global hyper-Bitcoinization. In its inaugural year, Bitcoin Amsterdam was the biggest European Bitcoin event in history. Held from October 12th to the 14th at Westergaas Event Forum, nearly 3,000 attendees jumped at the opportunity to learn, engage, and party with fellow Bitcoiners. 126 brilliant speakers from all over Europe and beyond took the stage to represent different angles and present various perspectives. Offering 6 different on-site locations and 3 fully programmed stages, we are absolutely stoked to catapult the European community to the global stage. Tickets are at their lowest prices right now. Lock yours in at b.tc/conference/Amsterdam. That's b.tc/conference/Amsterdam.